Session which is entitled Church-State Individual Mediating Compromise. And those are a lot of big words, and I'll be using at the beginning here some rather large abstract words. These are sort of rituals that academics go through. We have our intellectual gymnastics, a lot of academic ivory tower hoop-de-doo. And once we're done with that, then we can get down to rather specific issues. And if you're wondering what kind of specific issues we're going to get to, let me at the beginning mention a few of these so that when I go through my intellectual acrobats and like the flying wall Lindas and the others up high, we'll be talking today about such things as whether or not Christmas should be commemorated in the schools. We'll be talking about whether or not churches should be registered as lobbies in Washington. We'll be talking about whether or not churches should be paying taxes. We'll be talking about whether or not the Internal Revenue Service should be allowed to inspect church records as an issue. We'll be talking about prayer and Bible reading in the public schools. And we'll be talking about whether or not churches should try to resist the growing encroachment of government in what we would call basic welfare services, such as daycare centers and care for the aged, care for retired, care for the ill, and many other instances like that. So while we're going through, as I say, some of the more formal things, you talking about such big words as legitimacy and alienation, we'll eventually get to these, because what I found here is what people enjoy talking about mostly are concrete, specific issues. And I would welcome your comments, criticisms, disagreements at any place. Don't be afraid just to, flag me and say you don't understand or I wasn't clear. Remember in the first session, John took about 5 minutes before he got the question just right. And sometimes it takes a certain amount of time to do that. And if I don't ask the question in a clear way, it's my fault, not your fault. I've learned that over 25 years of teaching and about 7 years of teaching here also. With this, and we'll go on without any further ado. Sometimes you can have so much introduction that you never get to where you want to go. I have to tell one. I like to tell stories. Some of you, I have to tell stories. One year we had the Dallas Cowboys train at our school. I teach at St. Olaf, and they did their summer training there, and they had what we call blocking islands, where I don't know if you know these things, but they're like big slabs of iron, and then they have blocking pads, and they have seven of them, and then they put seven men against them, and you practice the offensive line blocking out the defensive men, and you get seven men putting your shoulders against this thing, and then when you get enough men that are heavy enough, then you can push it, but it takes seven men to push these things, and these big hulks, prime livestock that show up on the professional football teams, although I like professional football very much, and although we don't have Frank Tarkenton anymore, I'm sorry to say, but we'll get another one pretty soon. But anyway, my son was about 5 years old, and he was watching. He was very impressed. I mean, we had Bob Lilly, and we had D.D. Lewis, and all these people you see on Sunday afternoons, or some of you. I know Emily doesn't, but from her remarks last week. But anyway, you had all these people pushing these livestock specimens pushing these islands, and my son was very impressed. And so after practice was over, we were watching, he decided that he was going to do it, and he went right up and put his shoulder to it, and nothing happened. He backed off two or three steps, hit it with his shoulder, nothing happened. Went back about 10 yards, ran full tilt, nothing happened. Finally, in exasperation, he went back about 50 feet and went at the blocking island as hard as he could. Obviously, nothing happened. And the last attempt, he went back about 100 feet. By that time, he was so tired with his introduction, and by the time he got to the blocking island, he didn't have any strength left. He gave up altogether with this. So it's possible to have such a long introduction, which I just did. We won't get to the issues themselves with this. All right. Now, many kinds of ways of defining the problem. What we'll be talking about all week are specific issues with American religious life today. What are some of the questions? What are some of the issues? And last week, for some of you who were here, we had some sort of broad gauge, wide spectrum view of these. And this time, we'll be dealing with some of the more specific issues. Like this is the commercial coming up now. Tomorrow, we'll be dealing with why is it there is a decline in church attendance in certain denominations, and then we'll be talking about creationism. That's always a very lively one. That's going on right now. And then, what does it mean to be religious in American life today? How do you go about measuring these kinds of things? But the problem I want to talk about today, and to get to these specific issues that I just mentioned, is I think this, that is we live in the world, as we look at the world in which we live, I should say, the world seems to be getting much more complex. The world seems to be getting much more difficult to control. It seems as though as people, as small groups, families, individuals, as communities, some people I'll talk about in a minute call mediating agencies, we have so little influence on our lives. It seems as though the big decisions in the world and the big decisions in our lives are being made out there, at the state capitol or at national church headquarters or in Washington or New York or something else like this. And it leads really to us, the specialists here call a sense of alienation. It leads to a sense that there's nothing really we can do about our lives, and therefore, instead of organizing and trying to find some organized way in which we can actually make a difference, we sort of retreat and draw into ourselves and have what we talked about last week as sort of a privatist religion. The only thing we can do is sort of take care of ourselves. We can't really do anything about Washington or the other great decisions. Yet at the same time, we are people of faith, we are believers, and we would like to think that our faith would make a difference in public life. On the one hand, we feel alienated or lost or cut off from the big decisions over here, yet I think very few of us would want to think that our faith was only a private matter, only something that was limited to our immediate devotions, our immediate prayer life, our immediate, daily kinds of situations. We are alienated on the one hand, and yet we are looking for, to use the big term here, legitimacy, or some legitimate way in which we can use our faith to influence public life. And the problem we run up against there is that in the United States, by contrast to many other countries, we have very strict separation of church and state, and I don't think any of us today would want to change. That's in the First Amendment. Any of us would seriously want to change of church and state. So we're caught in the problem of having strong religious convictions and the belief that our faith should make some difference, yet at the same time, a long tradition going way back to the Constitution, going way back to 1776, if you like, of very strict regulation and as much as possible separation of church and state. And we like to pride ourselves on the fact that the church doesn't tell the state, the state doesn't tell the church what to do, but yet we would like to have more influence. I think many of us at least would like to have more influence on public policy than is going on. And this seems to be getting stronger rather than lesser. Putting it about another way, there seem to be an increasing number of tensions and problems and conflict between church and state in our day than there were even 10, 15 years ago. The problem seems to be getting stronger rather than lesser. You'd think we'd be able to solve some of our problems, but the problems are getting worse rather than diminishing. There are some problems that are, as I say, getting worse. Now, to address this problem, I'm going to draw on the writings of two important religious thinkers in this country. By coincidence, and I really mean that by coincidence, they happen to be Lutheran, because I don't think that Lutherans have any kind of monopoly at all on this. But they are both very active in public life. They are both well-versed in theology and in what we would call social ethics. And they have combined over the years on books and articles and different things. And I won't go to the board, I'm too lazy on a rainy Monday. You can talk to me afterwards if you want. The two are, first of all, a pastor and an editor in Brooklyn by the name of Richard John Neuhaus, N-E-U-H-A-U-S. The name may be familiar to some of you as the Parish St. John's in Brooklyn, and also is editor of an excellent magazine called Worldview, and still very active and lively today. The other is a professional sociologist or a specialist within that sociology of religion by the name of Peter Berger, who some of you may know. His best-known book came out in 1961, The Noise of Solemn Assemblies, and so on. And they have come up with an idea that the way to get through this problem of, on the one hand, respecting American separation of church and state. We don't want we don't want to stay church in this country. And yet, on the other hand, we want to have the church have some influence in public life. They have come up with the idea of what they call mediating institutions. That's a big term, mediating institutions, as a way of using what we would call voluntary groups to which we belong, and the church is one of those churches, in order to have more influence on public life. And so, mediating institutions, and that's why, and they would act as agencies for compromise. That's why I have the title then, you see, Church, State, Individual, then colon, I suppose, mediating compromise, and the mediating compromise would be that which is done by these voluntary associations, which I'll be talking about. Okay, so far, that's the introduction that I should have finished 5 minutes ago, if I, you know, leave out the bad jokes and so on. We'll leave out some of the irrelevant jokes, although I love to tell stories. And we're going to have a story, another commercial. We are going to have a storytelling session this week, aren't we, at night? Didn't we decide on that?
It wasn't decided on yet.
It wasn't firmly decided on. Put pressure on Larry and John and the others to have a storytelling night. We've done that. I was here one winter, and the young people have forgotten, and I see some other people of my same age, and I'm delighted, how much fun it is to sit around and tell stories for a couple hours instead of turning on the Dukes of Hazzard or see who shot JR or whatever it was. Just simply telling great stories.
Erling tells a story.
Oh yeah, I tell a story here. All right. Anyway, when I was here, in the wintertime up here, you know, we don't have a wide variety of things to do at night, and so we tell stories. Okay. Anyway, so the introduction here is clear on basically the problem. Now, let me give a very concrete example, and some of you I know are directly and professionally involved in what I'm going to be talking about here, and I would very much welcome your expert, professional comments on this. Okay. The specific problem is that of the American family. It could be, it could be any Western country, but the family and what's happening to the family illustrates, I think, this trend that I'm talking about, the dilemma that I'm talking about very well here. We all agree, I think, that the family is the anchor, the basis for what we would call our civilization. Without the family, the civilization such as we know it itself would simply collapse with us. All right. And we know that the family is under severe strain today. I, for a while, thought of doing some things on the crisis in the family, and then I said, you've heard this so many times that the family's in crisis that it wouldn't add to anything more that you knew about. Okay, but we know that the family is in crisis today. Now, one reason the family is in crisis today is that the older model, and if you like big words, I know what paradigm means, just to let you know that I don't like jargon words. The older model of the self-sufficient family is no longer operational. We no longer really hold up or cherish or value the idea of the all-sufficient family, the family that can basically take care of just about all of its problems by itself, within itself, with us. This model of the all-sufficient family from the past is being challenged, and is being challenged by people with honorable intentions. I'm not saying that there's any kind of plot or any kind of conspiracy at work at all here. People, specialists in certain fields I'll be talking about, have the best of intentions in trying to help families through some of the problems which have been increasing in our time. And we have an increase in specialists providing services to help, to supplement, to support the family as the strains on the family are becoming stronger all the time. And let me list some of these, and I'm drawing here from several sources. One of the best is a book we discussed at great length the winter I was here, Christopher Lash's book, The Culture of Narcissism. L-A-S-C-H, Christopher Lash, The Culture of Narcissism. All right. Now, what Lash argues is that the specialists uphold domestic life, they uphold the idea of the self-sufficient family. Yet, they argue that the family cannot really take care of itself without outside assistance. And this is a trend that's going on. For instance, and I've got about three or four for instances here, you take the advertising industry, and I know it's always easy to pick on the advertising industry and make it a whipping boy and for all kinds of things, but anyway, I'll go through this. The advertising industry, for instance, tells us today that the health and safety of the young, the satisfaction of their daily nutritional requirements, their emotional and intellectual development, and their ability to cope with their peers, on and on, all the problems facing the young today depend on, for instance, consumption on vitamins, it depends on Band-Aids, It depends on cavity-preventing toothpaste, on cereals, mouthwashes, and laxatives. Well, you know, he's half serious and half facetious about this, but the point is that advertisers have found that family-aiding products sell, and that families need to be told what products they should buy in order to be, you know, self-sufficient. Or more specifically, we find domestic science today urging the housewife and the mother to systematize housekeeping and give up rule of thumb procedures that had sufficed for a long time in the past. In a sense, changing or reducing housekeeping into something like almost like a factory. We find modern medicine ordering the abandonment of home remedies. That would be a very good example with this. I was so pleased once I went to an old doctor, and what did he come up with? Mustard plaster is the remedy for me, and instead of sending me off to Mayo Clinic, for 3 days of tests and lots of bills. All right. And for emotional stress, for instance, we have a huge industry here of counselors, of advisors, of government workers. We have juvenile courts, we have caseworkers, we have guidance counselors, all, you see, offering help, in a sense, supplementing the family. But the point I'm trying to get at here is that it means that the model of the older self-sufficient family, in a very real sense, is breaking down, and we feel that something as precious and as close to us as our families are now dependent on outside support, and there's very little we can do about it. And hence the sense of alienation. Hence the sense that the legitimacy of the family is no longer as strong as it once used to be, because now the family can survive, and this, you know, is certainly very real for many of us, probably even in here. The survival of the family depends on how successful the specialists are, instead of the generalists in helping the family survive itself. And we don't really know quite what to do about this kind of situation. We would like to go back to sort of the older self-sufficient model, but we find that the problems are so complex that we depend on the specialists. Now, we can talk about that one if you like. You can put that one up as a specific problem to talk about, but obviously I've got more. Sometimes I only bring in a page or two of notes, but this time we've got more, so we'll plunge ahead. If you want to come back to the family thing, that would be fine. All right. What's happening with the family leads them to a sense of alienation, of being out of touch with what is happening, a loss of control over our lives, and not having a sense of a loss of legitimacy, not having the authority, for instance, as parents, to really carry out the goals and values we have for our families with us. The big decisions, in other words, are being made farther away from us, without the approval of the people affected. The whole question of whether or not government-sponsored, you know, this came up in the 1980 election, government-sponsored daycare centers are really a threat to break up the family. And obviously some people said yes and other people said no with this. And why should the government be doing this sort of thing in the first place? If you're gonna have daycare centers, why, and some people have to have, you know, both wife and husband and working, why shouldn't they be done in the churches? Why should the government get involved in this? And once the government is involved, don't you get so wrapped up in bureaucracy, red tapes, reports, Title IX, and all the other things that they become so cumbersome that they just sort of fall over? I know at our college, for instance, it's only 3,000 students. The president estimated that it cost over $100,000 a year just to pay for the paperwork, just to take care of the government. With this, and if we didn't have it, obviously we wouldn't have the government support, and we'd be an even worse problem with this. All right, now to our specialists here, who I'm quoting, Peter Berger and Richard John Newhouse, and I want to go slowly on this. I know I talk too fast, but I'm too old to change. But anyway, to our specialists, Berger and Newhouse, what is lacking today is what they would call a linkage between these vast impersonal institutions, like the schools, like the government, like business, these big policy-making decision institutions, which seem so far away from us, there seems to be a lack of linkage between these vast institutions and the values by which we live day by day. It seems as though what we really believe in makes no real difference in the way the world at least our own society is going. That John would say, "Can you feel that?" That's one of John's favorite expressions. Can you feel that? That our day by day values seem to make so very little difference. in the way in which the world is going. It seems to give you a good example. We talked about this a little bit last week. When the United States in the United Nations was the only nation of the 100 or so that voted one way on the Nestle's, the Nestle's boycott through the WHO, with this, and the churches had been sending in all kinds of resolutions, all kinds of good intended intention people had been saying this is what the church should do. The government simply realized, that the church voice didn't make that much difference, and that they could safely ignore the churches on this, and we were the only country in the whole world that could do this. That wouldn't have happened, some time ago. As an indication, that's an illustration of what I'm trying to say, of how little our day-by-day values seem to make any decision, any impact down there. Okay, I want to be sure. That sort of thing. So the solution then, as I mentioned earlier, is to create what they call mediating structures or institutions, to provide linkage, to provide a way in which our day-by-day values, especially as church people, especially as believers, can make some kind of difference on the direction public life and public policy is taking in the world today. With this, and they argue that the case isn't hopeless. We aren't on a course in which the institutions are going to inevitably get bigger and bigger and further beyond public control. The worst thing to do is to become fatalistic about thinking that there is not going to be a direct impact between voluntary or what they call mediating institutions and the impact on the government itself. Okay. Now, so far okay? Okay, well, all right, with this, okay. Because sometimes, you go through material so often it becomes so familiar. Just like when you're writing and you think this is really great stuff, and you send it to an editor, and 2 weeks later it comes back and there's more writing from the editor than you've written yourself, and how dare he touch my immortal prose, but that big blue pencil gets going, so I welcome comments with this. All right, now what kind of sort of small scale or smaller scale mediating institutions are Berger and Newhouse talking about here? With this. They are talking specifically about institutions such as families, be they nuclear families, that is immediate families, or extended families, where you might have three or even four generations living together in one household. They are talking about professional associations, businessmen's associations, or I went to a convention and at the same time here was the Michigan Dental Association. I never really had thought much about the Michigan Dental Association before, but they did things and tried to have an impact on public policy that would help the Dental Association, both in the state capital, I'm sure, in Washington. That would be a professional association with this, or many of the other. Churches would be the one we're most concerned with today, another example of mediating institutions. Other ones that we all, I think, or most of us would be familiar with would be things like the League of Women Voters would be a very good one, as a mediating voluntary association that seeks to do good things. In Northfield, I can only quote from personal examples, the League of Women Voters has a splendid little pamphlet out specifically on all the ways in which one can get involved in politics, where to go, who makes decisions, who's accountable, all this. So it's laid out clearly who to call in time of trouble, who to call a complaint to with this, and it's all done on a voluntary basis, and it's very helpful. Same thing is done with the school board, so it wouldn't be that. Or that brings up another mediating institution, that would be the PTA. Sometimes we laugh at the dear old PTA and so on, but it can serve, and oftentimes has served, as a useful mediating kind of institution with us. The Scouts, Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, Campfire Girls, this would be another kind of mediating institution in which we have our own personal day-by-day values, and we want to see these have some impact or make a difference, you see, on public policy. We can't do it alone, so we joined voluntarily, that's the point. We join these voluntary associations and hope that they can, they can make some difference. On the local level, then maybe, on the county level, then up to the state level, and beyond with us. All right. Now, from the individual standpoint, talking about mediating institutions, from the individual's viewpoint, they offer the opportunity, you see, for face-to-face contact with people who share the same interests that they do. That's why you join the League of Women Voters, or Scouts, or PTA, or whatever else it is. You have a chance, you have an opportunity to join with people who share the same interests that you do. The mediating institutions share and they support the personal values of the members, and out of this comes a sort of a sense of communal values. You realize you aren't alone. I know this is sort of basic stuff, but we're going to get to those questions. You find that you're not alone in thinking that you would like to see certain changes or reforms or improvements made in society, so you join these sort of things, and again, on a voluntary basis. And they provide, really, according to Berger and Newhouse here, they provide a moral foundation in their ability to create and to sustain values in a world in which it seems as though moral values are on the decline, in a world in which we've so separated church and state that it seems as though they are almost separate airtight compartments, and therefore we feel all the more isolated, to come back to what I said before, from belief that our faith will make any difference at all in public life. But the mediating voluntary associations really can do this. All right. So what they call for then really is a recognition that if there's going to be any kind of change, if there's going to be any kind of impact on public policy, it has to start not on an individual basis. The individuals alone simply can't do anything. It just would be impossible. You start your own letter writing campaign, it's not going to make any difference at all with this. You start with your own kind of voluntary institution and work with it, where you find people who are interested in the same things that you are, share the same values that you are, and you develop sort of a sense of communal linkage with one another, and therefore have a way of getting out of this very difficult situation of feeling alone or isolated or alienated with us. That would be the first step. All right. Now, so let's turn to sort of chapter two here. I don't want to, Paul Harvey says, and now for page two, but that's about the only thing I ever want to quote from Paul Harvey.
Bumper sticker of the day.
What?
A bumper sticker of the day is worth quoting from him.
All right.
Well, and I don't have it.
Oh, you don't have it. Oh, I see, a bumper sticker, right. Yeah.
He ends this program with the bumper sticker of the day.
A bumper sticker of the day, right. in Northfield, the bumper sticker of the day is drive carefully, Norwegian driver, would be one of that. You can change that to Swedish or German, whatever you want, depending on where you are. All right. Now, sort of anyway, here would be Paul Harvey's page two. That we have here. Now, we want to, with all these voluntary associations that I've mentioned here, PTA and Scouts and so many of the others, we, I think, at Holden are specifically interested in what the role of the churches can be. And the difficulty is that where the government might be responsive to PTA, League of Women Voters, any of these others, because of our tradition of separation of church and state, the government is very remiss to get involved in anything in which it would seem as though the organized churches had a direct impact on public policy. This is what we call a total separationist school of church-state relations, led, just to mention the name, by a very distinguished constitutional scholar named Leo Pfeffer, but that's just a little academic aside. All right. Now, since the church seems to have so little impact on public life, what many church people have concluded is really two things. We have accepted, according to Berger and Newhouse, we have accepted really two things. First, that the influence of religion will continue to decline in the light of more education, in the light of more knowledge and more technology and everything else. There are those who argue that religion, the impact of religion, is really declining over a long period of time. And there are those who have sort of accepted this idea, that even by the year 2000, for instance, the local parish will be about as active as the Grange is in your local community. And if you know the local Grange, it really doesn't have much of an impact anymore anywhere. It's just sort of slowly, and not so slowly, dying up. They've argued that in these voluntary associations, the church is dying up. I mean, many people have accepted that. All right. But they argue, or some people don't believe that the parish is dying, and I'll talk about that specifically tomorrow. But they say even if religious faith continues to flourish, many people have accepted the idea that faith deals only with the private sphere of life, not with the public. and that faith is simply a matter of one's private life, and thus it's irrelevant to trying to shape public policy, the privatist interpretation with this. And hence, we are in a dilemma, according to Berger and Newhouse here, you see, in the idea that it is really the church people, the believers, who have themselves created much of the problem. It isn't the fact just that we've got a big faceless bureaucracy down in Washington which seems impervious to our needs. It's the fact that many church people themselves have simply accepted this condition and aren't really doing much about it. They simply said, that's the way it's going, it's too bad, we're going to let it go at this. And what Berger and Newhouse are arguing is, you know, it ain't necessarily so. It doesn't have to happen that way. They are calling for some sort of response on the part of the churches. They would argue, first of all, in response to these two points, that it is wrong to think that the influence of religion is declining just because, you know, there's more education, more technology, more modernization, all the rest of these things with this. They argue, in looking at this mediating institution thing, that religious institutions, you know, in all their complexity, religious hospitals, all kinds, old folks' homes, all sorts of things, not just, you know, the church on the corner, but all sorts of places, religious institutions make up the largest voluntary network in this country. I think that's an amazing thing. Religious institutions really make up the largest voluntary network of service agencies in the country, which, you know, they're still, you know, still going, and I know some of you in this room work for some of these institutions. All right, with us now. They say this: so long as our public policy ignores the contributions that these agencies can make, then our lives will be, you know, the poorer for this. We have the resources there. This voluntary network of religious voluntary institutions is there, and if we don't take advantage of them, if we don't use them to their best advantage, obviously it will continue to decline. And secondly, they argue it isn't true that religion is purely private. In many ways, religious values infiltrate in public thought, and that we have, in other words, resources here on which to draw if we want to have religion make a difference in public life. We just really, in a sense, haven't really tapped these to any great degree up until this time, but they are there. The resources aren't there. We aren't sort of bereft from them. So what they are arguing then is that we don't have to accept the totals, and here's where we get controversial, and I don't necessarily agree or disagree with some of these things, but I want to, you know, throw them out. Here is where really the argument can begin. To what degree then should churches become more directly involved with and accept public policy on the one hand, and also the question of the extent to which churches should accept the increasing degree and amount of government regulation over their lives, because that's a very clear trend of what's happening right now. And I want to give some examples of this. What is taking place is that the churches oftentimes, by default or out of fear, whatever reason might, you know, you might cite here, the churches are accepting the fact that they are more and more responsible to regulations by the government. And this is why church-state relations are much more tense than they have been for a considerable period of time with this. For instance, what's happened with the enormous input, I mean, the enormous increase in population is that we, compared to, say, the 19th century, look to the government, for instance, largely for care for the elderly, care for the handicapped, care for orphans and all these things, because the government can often do it more quickly. The government can generate a great deal more money. I'm not saying that the government can do it more efficiently, but it's simply much more it's much quicker, and therefore we have a government much more directly involved than ever before, and the churches have, you know, in a very real sense surrendered that. Or another thing, let's take as long as we're on homes for the elderly here, we have churches, according to Newhouse and Berger, and they don't like this, have surrendered some of their autonomy or their legitimacy to the government in stating in accepting the fact that the government has the right to license them. Because that means the government is coming in and telling a, quote, religious or a church-related institution what it has to do, and what it can and what it can't do. That seems to be I'll give you one example. My mother's in it happens to be an ALC home back in Minnesota, And the regulations are there such that the waste paper baskets in the rooms have to be made out of metal. You can't have wicker baskets because they're more flammable. With this, but when you know, you see the practical point may be a good one, and sometimes old people get a little forgetful and so on with this. But the point here is that the church-related homes have accepted government regulations. Another good example of this would be in Christian day schools, and there's a good piece in the last Time magazine on this. The Christian day schools have accepted the idea that they don't really have legitimacy unless they are accredited by the government. That the government itself has the right to say that this is a good school and that is a poor school because certain things are done here and not done there. Therefore, the church-related institutions, in a very real sense, are accepting the idea that the government has more and more increasing influence over their lives simply because, obviously, church schools or day schools want to have accreditation because that's a better selling point for parents. There is only one or two that I know of who don't do this. Bob Jones, down in Greensboro, North Carolina, prides itself on not having government accreditation. But most schools, do accept government accreditation. With this, all right. Now, other examples of where the problem of church-state relations seems to be getting, you know, more difficult rather than simpler, where the government is increasing its influence here, and people are having less and less, voice over this, and don't quite know how to fight back with this. The government, for instance, attempted to, through the IRS, require that all churches submit final financial statements for inspection the same way that, say, other charitable or philanthropic organizations do, like the American Heart Association or the American Cancer Association or any of the others of these, to be sure that that the money is going in the right place. Now, you can understand why that's the case, because sometimes some of these charitable organizations spend enormous amounts of money for themselves. Some of us from Minnesota remember the most famous case, the Sister Kenny Foundation, back in the 1950s, in which over half the money sent to Sister Kenny, who was fighting polio, remember, was going into the pocketbooks of a man named Marvin Klein, who had been mayor of Minneapolis. When they found out he was, I think he's still in jail, I don't know, but anyway. It also had some interesting ramifications because the person who prosecuted Marvin Klein was a very bright young attorney general from Minnesota by the name of Walter Mondale. We went on to hear from him later on, and he moved to the top politically quickly by prosecuting. It was a tailor-made case, for getting him. But that's just an aside. The government is tried to require that churches submit their books for inspection, as the government also looks at, as I say, things like American Heart Association's with us. And for all practical purposes here, the churches, according to Berger and Newhouse, are so, in a sense, afraid of losing their tax-exempt status that they're giving in. The churches, really, in a sense, aren't resisting. The one place where the churches did resist came in 1978 with the Christian Day School Association and movement, and it has sort of a mixed moral dimension to this. There were many times, especially in the 1960s, not so much now, but in the 1960s, many of the, you all know Christian day schools, what I'm talking about, right? And if you're from Wenatchee, Bethesda Christian is one of mixed, mixed background. But anyway, Christian day schools, many of them in the 1960s, got started as places where people, white parents, could take their children out of integrated schools and put them in segregated schools. Well, that was contrary to the law of the land. And the battle went back and forth. Shouldn't parents have the right to put their children in whatever school they wanted to? And what right did the government have to tell them that they shouldn't be able to do this? And George Wallace, got a lot of political mileage out of the fact that what right do these pointy-headed bureaucrats down in Washington have to tell parents what to do with their children? And if he had his way, if he were elected, he'd take all the briefcases from all these pointy-headed intellectuals and throw them in the Potomac. Politics of resentment kind of thing. As a way of doing this. Now, what happened in 1978 was that the government ordered that Day schools could not even exist unless they showed that they were making a sincere effort to have total racial integration. As a ruling coming from the government itself, and there was such a tremendous outburst of protest from these day school associations across the country that the government dropped it altogether. So what I'm suggesting here, you see, and what we can talk about specifically, and I'll get into these ones, is the difficulty of, on the one hand, wanting to have more voice, wanting to have the values of, you know, our beliefs make a difference, have an influence in Washington or wherever it might be, the state capital, whatever it happened to be from here, and yet finding the government sort of standing in opposition really to this. Should, for instance, I'll just mention three or four questions, and, you know, like a fisherman, I'm casting, and whichever one you want to strike at would be fine, for our discussion here. The government, for instance, is insisting on inspection of the books to see that, church's books, to see that where money is designated, that's where the money is spent. One specific example of this, with a PTL club, some of you know, with Jim Baker and so on, there is good reason to believe that some of the money that he said was going to go to foreign missions went to furnishing his own home. Now, should the government have the right to come in and demand that it should inspect these books to be sure that money went to foreign missions rather than to mahogany paneling in the Baker residency? Yeah.
Well, it seems to me that once the church gets involved in government, it has to compromise. The government demands that the church compromise. You take the Christian position and the atheist position, and the government wants to have an atheist Christian. Or if you get clean water and polluted water, they want to mix the two for the middle ground, and you end up with a polluted water. I don't see how churches, it seems to me that the only solution is to not get involved in the government processes, because once you're involved in the government processes, you're diluted, and you're forced to compromise.
There's an opening statement. Just talk to each other. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, we kind of want the government to define what a church is sometimes, because, like in our county, I am told that there is a family that lives out in the country who says, my house is my church, we have a family religion, therefore we want to be exempted from taxes. Well, someone has to define what the church is, I think.
And the government doesn't really want to do that. The government has stayed away for a long time, and the problem here, to complicate, I see what you're saying, that there are quacks, there are charlatans, there are rip-off artists around. I'm trying to think, Jim and Emily, the one we had in Minnesota a couple of months ago, they found somebody up in the Twin Cities.
They lost to both the state and the federal government in Minnesota.
I can't remember the name of it.
It was obviously cynical, and yet there are many marginal ones, as this man indicated, where I would hate to be the judge.
Yeah, right, very, very, very difficult. Give you a good example. Some of you are from California, the Worldwide Church of God, or whatever it is, it's the Armstrongs, anyway. And Herbert and Ted Garner, is it, or Garner Ted?
Garner Ted.
Everybody giggles with Ted Garner. The state of California decided that the Armstrongs were using their authority, for their own advantage, and they passed a law, didn't they? The state legislature. Even with something as blatant as the Armstrongs ripoff, the various associations said it would be worse to have the government be able to inspect the books than it would be to have a few quacks and charlatans like Garner Ted was. I think the old man was sincere. I think he was wrong in the theology, but I think he was sincere with us. Yeah.
Well, I guess I would feel that a lot of our services that are being provided in communities today with government funds are being provided through church-related agencies and institutions and organizations. I have to with one of those.
That's why I mentioned that. I have you in mind, right?
And it seems to me that that is not necessarily a record of infamous compromise. I think some good things can happen through that kind of pairing partnership where the government funding that's designated for aging services, or designated for daycare services, or designated for certain kinds of health services, community development services, are channeled through voluntary, private, in a sense, mediating institutions that are church-related, church sponsored. Now, I think on the other side of that is, if the churches in their voluntary institutions agree to take that kind of money, to provide those kinds of services, and believing that that way they can give those funds the kind of a human face. And it is not a bureaucracy that's providing them, it is a church organization. For example, Kansas City, we provide a great many services to the community, most of which are funded by tax dollars.
Yeah.
But the people who come to get those services come to Metropolitan Lutheran Ministry. They come, in many cases, they come to church buildings to use church office. But if we're agreeing to do that, then I think it's only proper to accept some regulation. Now, sometimes that regulation gets heavy-handed and too much, and we protest at that point. But unless the church is talking about offering a service only to its own constituents, then I think you can make a case for not having regulation from government, and without no government funding. But if we're saying we want to provide services to the community, to people who are not Lutherans, who are not part of our fellowship, and we feel that's our responsibility, and we can do that effectively, and that's part of our mission, then it seems to me it is only appropriate to subject our services to the scrutiny of the public, as represented by the government. Because certainly there are nursing homes that are church-sponsored, and they claim they want to take anybody who comes, and they don't have the kind of services or the kind of facilities that you would want to put your mother or your father into. And if I'm going to entrust a loved one to an institution, then I think it's only fair, if I'm not a member of the governing board of that institution, that I know that someone is, and it has to be through my elected representative government, is exercising some oversight.
It is not true that society should be able to regulate itself. That if we are going to have institutions, then if we don't regulate ourselves, then other bodies will. And we're the ones who make the decisions by neglect, indifference, apathy.
Yes. And that's what they're arguing here, yes.
Also, like walking the fine line between state and church. Like, all religions kind of people sincere in what they're doing. And just in the news, a month ago, was where New York City has decided that the movies could not be exempted from taxes. You know, it's going to be what is a sincere religion? Mm-hmm. And where does the state step in?
Yeah. I'm supposed to have a good teacher would have an instant summation here to keep the conversation going. I'm just wondering if somebody else will pick up the ball while I'm regathering my thoughts here. Because one of the fun things here is not having sort of a formal list of questions that everybody sort of has to answer, as you do in a classroom or something. With this, I think, would we all agree that some form of government, as you suggest, some form of government supervision or regulation is necessary largely to protect the honest people? Is that what you're suggesting, against the rip-off artists?
Well, sometimes even when we're honest, we're not always alert and sensitive. For example, the whole issue of accessibility for handicapped people. You know, as I observe churches, in many cases, the churches are the last ones. In some cases, we build ramps,
yes,
and install bathrooms,
yes,
that will permit,
yes,
handicapped persons to use that worship facility.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we don't do it until the government reminds us that we ought to do that for certain
times. I'm just thinking, my home church, we've got 18 steps going up and there's no ramp.
Mm-hmm.
We're with this sort of thing. The very fine line on where what to do about this. But on the other hand, the obvious danger is that once you know, I can't think of a Latin term, but it comes out, beware the opening wedge. Caveat emptor or something else, isn't that, caveat emptor, anyway, I like to put lots of different foreign words on the title to impress you, to show you that I can, you know, handle five or six different languages. I had one teacher that, unless he had words from five or six different languages on the board by the time the hour was over, his class period was a failure. Anyway, beware the opening wedge, because once the opening wedge is there, then, you know, where do you stop? Is that something that you're suggesting?
Well, I think in history, if we look back and the way things are today, the government has always demanded compromise. What would be the government position, for example, if the Bible was submitted to a government agency? Here again, it would have to be included with a number of other ideas and so forth, and it wouldn't be the Bible.
I'm sorry.
Well, this is I just don't think whenever the government does anything, it almost always starts out to solve a problem, and there's a real good reason for it. But then that can be used against you later on, and then
yes,
our institutions. A number of them have grown in bureaucracy and so forth, and they usually end up leaving openings for people to manipulate our lives to our disadvantage.
I have to say, on the other hand, there are many things that the government has done that I think are useful and helpful and necessary, as you suggested with some places. And just a couple of the instances where I was overseas, we complained, and I happen to have spent 4 months, and not just as an example, it doesn't have anything to do with church here, but I was in northern Thailand for 4 months. And we had a U.S. government agency there called the USIS, the United States Information Service, and it was absolutely first rate. I mean, it is a low budget, and they really did a good job. And one reason Thailand, which is a very critical country in that part of the world, is favorable towards the United States is that the United States government has a first rate program to keep the Thai people informed and loyal and supporting us. And they weren't, you know, it wasn't, gee whiz, what a great place America is. They showed America's problems. And one night I tuned in, for instance, and they had Woody Guthrie's, on The Voice of America, they had Woody Guthrie's program writing his songs about the Depression in the 1930s, and Woody Guthrie wasn't very happy about America, as he found it in the 1930s. So there are times when, all I'm saying is that there are times when the government, you know, does some work about that, but oftentimes that isn't the case. I think that's true, and there is a danger of compromise. Emily, you were
there. I was concerned about the government's prayer in the school.
Yeah.
And that.
Now, let me put the mediating, here's where Newhouse and Berger, and they're Lutherans, and it's kind of surprised me, but they're also politically conservative. And that may make a difference here. What they argued is, and there are two things, and the same thing is true for what we call the voucher plan, or that if parents send children to Christian day schools, that should be allowed to be deductible on their, you know, from their gross adjusted income. I hate to bring up, you know, something that you've tried to forget since April 15th, the gross adjusted income. What is it, line 26? Or wherever it was, but we do have to live with, you know, line 26 is all the rest of our lives. But they argue two things in answer to your question. They argue if we are going to have if believers are going to have an impact, if the day-by-day values of which we believe in are going to make any difference at all, one, we have to allow parents to benefit from sending their children to Christian day schools, or it could be Judeo day schools too, because there are plenty of those throughout different parts of the country. On the one hand, because there they learn certain values which, as believers, we think are important and which will contribute to the well-being and the stability of the country. Okay? And the other thing is that they say that voluntary prayer is necessary because this is oftentimes the only time in which a large number of children are exposed to any kind of religious exercises at all in the schools, and therefore, since it is voluntary, there is no kind of stigma attached to those who don't participate, and therefore, what they are arguing is that here is a case where the government can allow what they call values generating institutions to make a contribution to influencing public policy. Does everybody want to agree with those two? I mean, public Bible reading and public prayer in schools, for instance. So that's all. That's back in the news. This isn't just something that is of antiquated interest, but it's back in the news again because what we used to call the Becker Amendment, named for a Representative Becker in 1964, is back on the agenda again in Washington. Anybody want to take a swing at Bible reading and prayer in the public schools? by silence, are we saying that's a good thing?
No.
Okay.
If I can see no harm or danger to any one group of people, if those who want to listen and those who want to be involved in Bible reading and prayers in school, if by the same token, if you can tell the kids, my grandkids, if they come scribbling out of some said poo somewhere a million years ago, and along with a lot of other things suddenly became what we are. And because I tell people that if that's what they, where they come from, that's fine. But me, I'm created in the image of God. But that's what they teach, you see.
I'm going to take that one on Thursday, so you better be wrong.
That's a hard offer about being when I...
And that's all we got to learn.
But the thing that's... What upsets me mostly is that everybody is so afraid they're going to talk about God and Jesus, but they don't have any trouble talking about homosexuality. They have no trouble talking about sexual encounters or anything else, or abortion and all the rest of it, evolution and all those kind of things in schools. And nobody gets all uptight about that. Last year, the superintendent of schools of this state, there were some people having Christmas programs, Christmas trees, and singing Christmas carols in the school, and the state superintendent, he could not get out on the line fast enough to tell these principals, hey, you better be careful, because you might run afoul of the law. And so they all had to pull their horns back. And I tell you, and then people just sat there, okay, I guess that's the way it is.
Yeah, or if you're going to have Christmas carols, then like you say, we got to hear from the homosexuals and maybe the witchcraft people, and we got to be democratic.
Yeah, all right, anyway.
Well, this is a problem. When you get involved in government organizations, it's insisted that in our democracy that we hear from all sides. So if we're going to have a prayer in the public school, then we got to hear every other possible idea that people may have.
You hear it anyway, but you're not hearing the prayer in school.
I attend the Greek Orthodox Church Bible study on Saturday mornings, and the priest there had some agreement with a quip that is not original with me. I said, with some irony and sarcasm, the great service of the organized church for almost 2,000 years is to give people in society such a light dose of Christianity that they are inoculated against the real thing. and that public prayer and these other things are such a light dose that they leave less than a little bitty pimple on us in the old days when we were vaccinated. So I just don't know whether it does any good or bad. What does that little pimple do? It certainly inoculates us against early Christians who had both stripes and the equivalent of smallpox scars from one end of their bodies to the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I tend to agree too that prayer and Bible reading in schools in a formal way is counterproductive, that it's a nod out of respect or something like that. In fact, I read about a church in Washington, D.C. That I think is very unique and unusual, in the books by Elizabeth O'Connor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Church of Our Savior.
Uh-huh. And in that church, they wouldn't let children into their Sunday schools unless they were rather sure that there was Christian education going on in the home. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe more of our parishes could even learn from that practice, that even in our churches, that we let the Sunday school be a substitute or an inoculation into religion for children that aren't really getting much of a founding in Christian way of life in their homes.
Okay. I guess I feel that the proper focus of discussion with regard to the public school's relationship to teaching of religion is really misguided and misplaced at this point, and it would be really a helpful contribution that the churches could make if we would try to move the point of discussion to a little bit of a different arena, which would be to say that is the school's function, and is an educational, appropriate educational function for the schools to teach the history and cultural contributions of faith communities. Mm-hmm. That's not really happening. Mm-hmm. And that's a great loss.
It is happening in our schools.
In some schools it is, but it's still rare. And that can be done under the current Supreme Court rule.
Right, it's
no
done
problem.
Under the category of history.
Yeah.
One thing that, I asked pastors at Holden and pastors that I have been with in the Northwest here, what are the passions of their children? One pastor said, it's great sacrifice that son bought a $2,000 sports car, which broke the next week. Another pastor said, his son grew up when John Lennon died. I tell you, even the children of pastors, even your children and mine, they have no concern for the Bible that I've been able to detect. But they have a great passion for sports cars, for John Lennon, for the powerful things that Rocky Horror Movie, Midnight in Minneapolis. So the passions of children in our own home, they have been carefully, skillfully inoculated against anything that we claim is important.
So I'm in the back there in the green.
Yeah, it seems to me that originally there was what was called the wall of separation between church and state, and now they're talking about unnecessary entanglement, mm-hmm. and it's sort of a dynamic situation in which we're faced with a dilemma in that we certainly want to educate our youngsters and each other in the Christian faith, yet in order to, if for no other reason, to safeguard our own rights to believe as we do, we have to take quite seriously that separation and make quite certain that even if it isn't a wall, that line is never erased.
Yeah, because once it is, the dangers of one, you know, one voice or one community of faith dominating, you know, the others, or else sort of a totally secularist position taking over is just as frightening, yes.
Have you gone into, or are you planning to go into any of your sessions on what the so-called moral majority is doing?
Well, we didn't make it Friday, but Saturday we talked about this, right?
Are you going to do it this week?
Yeah, I'll be glad to anytime. I hadn't put it on the agenda because we're supposed to alternate, but I'll give a commercial for myself. Say what's on your mind. I just got a book, and I was kind of glad to see it sold out at the bookstore. But
yeah.
I've got a book on them. It's called The Politics of Moralism, The New Christian Right in American Life, and it's in the bookstore. And some people here have already read it. I dedicated it to Jim and Emily here. That's kind of a little family situation here, but be glad to. And what they are arguing, we can certainly take that up here, is that since the family, in a sense, and we talked about that at the beginning today, has virtually abdicated its responsibilities for what we call moral instruction and what's right and everything leading to the situations that Jim was talking about and all the rest, you can't expect any help or support from that. And the churches really, in a sense, aren't doing what they're supposed to, because they would argue that the churches have become so wrapped up in what they would call a self-social gospel, that it behooves the government to do this. And this is the surprising thing to see about the moral majority people, that they call on the one hand for less government in our lives, but at the same time, they want to use the power of the national government inject certain very clearly defined moral values back into public life again. And to them, that's not a contradiction, but to me, I think it, I think it is. Let's take the most, we're on prayer, the one case in which it all came up, that was called the New York Regents prayer. Regent simply means the Board of Governors over the New York State Board. It's the State Board of Education, is what it is. Okay. Now, the prayer they had in New York, and this is the one that led to the 1972 decision, 62 decision. One was Bible reading, one was prayer. And it isn't true that Madeline Mayer, whatever name, O'Hare, was responsible. I mean, she was the final catalyst. People say if we only didn't have Madeline O'Hare, we never would have had this. There were all kinds of other people waiting to do this. It's just that they happened to pick up that particular case. with us. She's not a female Satan in that sense. You know, some people have made her out to be, but the Regent's Prayer started off. I mean, it sounded so innocuous and so harmless. It said something like, you know, Our Father in Heaven, and then asked for daily guidance and everything through the day. Well, that made, you know, a tremendous number of theological assumptions. First of all, it assumed that there was a God, and it assumed that the God heard that there was a, that this God heard prayers, and that this God was able to answer prayers. Well, for a lot of people, to have that introduced, you see, into a public school is something which, you know, they didn't want their children to hear or to be exposed to, and therefore the Supreme Court ruled it out. And the moral majority is coming back and saying that if the Supreme Court is going to do that, then we're going to do the one thing that the Supreme Court can't touch. We're going to pass a constitutional amendment, which means the Supreme Court has to uphold what we pass. The one way to circumvent Supreme Court, two ways to circumvent Supreme Court opinions. One is to impeach Supreme Court justices, which is very, very difficult. I think there have been two in all of American history who have been impeached. And that's what we like to call gross moral turpitude. And so on. And remember, under Johnson, wasn't it old Abe Fortas? When they found he had a conflict of interest, he was ruling on some cases in which he owned stock. You know, that was, you know, not too great on his part. But so you can't get them really by impeachment. So the only other way is constitutional amendment. And they are saying, therefore, that they want to give that kind of power, you see, to the federal government to make moral decisions. And for some people, that's kind of a frightening. Prospect, yeah.
I'm not sure if I'm absolutely correct here, but that a constitutional convention can be very, very dangerous to the Bill of Rights, as I understand it. It can be amended, changed, taken out.
Yeah, couple comments there. There's what he's talking about is there is, and I think 24 states have approved it, if I'm not mistaken. It was in the Seattle Times last week. There is a call to have another constitutional convention, just like in Philadelphia in 1787. In which representatives would come together, and then if they wanted to, they could simply rewrite the entire American Constitution. There are all kinds of complicating questions, whether or not it's legal, valid, who would be called, you need two-thirds, three-quarters, and all sorts of things. And that's a possibility, because a lot of people don't like this. And the other point here is, every year, I forget which political science teacher at the University of Minnesota does this, but he has his students in constitutional law take a copy of the Bill of Rights downtown in Minneapolis, and just have a copy of that and ask people to read it, and will you sign it? Or they do it at the state fair or wherever they can find a lot of people, and over 70% of the people say it's a radical document that they won't sign. And this is the first 10 amendments, which really gets you, I think it used to be McLaughlin at Political Science in Minnesota that used to do that, and which gets, you know, which means that some people haven't done their homework somewhere in explaining this. And how easy it is to get excited and about when you have a problem, to have quick and easy instant changes. You know, everything in America has to be instant. And if we don't like something, we change it instantly. I'm, you know, like John was earlier, I'm preaching now, I'll warn you, just like John said, he's preaching. And one of the most beneficial aspects of the Constitution of 1787 was the fact that they built in great complexity in changing the Constitution. Very, very slow. It is cumbersome, it is inefficient, and that was done by design. Because they recognized, just a history, a brief reference in history, in 1789, the French had a revolution, and they changed their Constitution overnight. It was August 4th, in which they got, you know, the legislative chamber got in a passion. You know, anything you can do, I can do better kind of mentality. And by the time they were done in the morning, they had rewritten the entire Constitution. And they had got completely swept away with the emotions of the time. And such stalwarts as John Adams and Benjamin Franklin and all the rest saw the dangers of this sort of thing and tried to make change in the Constitution a very complicated kind of thing. I think they succeeded. But sometimes we get very frustrated with this. And this feeds things like moral majority, which come in and say, we need a quick, instant fix. And the more, you know, the more amendments you have to a constitution, the more difficult it becomes to administer. The more rules there are, the more complicated your life becomes. And that's where I see the danger with something like that today. That's my sermon. Anyway. Mm-hmm. Where is this? Any other? Yes.
There are a couple of examples of religion in public life that I think we might remind ourselves. One is the beautiful prayer that we all heard when we watched the inauguration of the president. And we haven't heard anyone saying that we shouldn't have prayers at presidential inauguration.
Every session of Congress is open with prayer. There's an official chaplain paid by the government. We have military chaplains paid by the government. There's no separation there, right?
And another comment is that we have Christian chaplains in the military forces, and when are we going to have Mooney chaplains and that sort of things? And of course, I don't want them there. Therefore, maybe some separation is required.
Yeah, this is,
Did Jesus ever try to really influence the politics of his day? I mean, he gave unto Caesar what was Caesar's. But really, he wasn't, as far as I can recall, interested in becoming part of the political process.
Well, Romans 13, of course, about being obedience to the powers over you. And the best answer is, I hate to say it, Martin Luther. I think, because I've been brought up as a Lutheran, I've been brought up a Presbyterian, I'd probably quote John Knox at this point. Methodist, I'd quote Charles Wesley or something. But Luther's doctrine of the two kingdoms, I think, is the one that the Lutherans use at this point, in which there are the two kingdoms, and in order to have civil society, you simply have to have government to take care of roads and law enforcement and defend the shores against foreign. It's just what we call the orders of creation is the theological jargon that's used here. And that should be exempt from the spiritual kingdom, the reign of Christ on earth with this. And that Luther didn't want much penetration, whereas Calvin looked at this and said, we have to have a, quote, Christianizing society. Luther never wanted the Christianized society. Maybe that's one reason my flag goes up when I see hear people talk about a Christian America.
It's impossible, I think.
Yeah,
I think it's like pouring pure water into polluted water.
Yeah.
I mean, it's still going to be polluted.
Yeah, and
that's true. Well, I agree.
And that, that would be the answer, that Jesus never quarreled with the existing institutions so long as the opportunity was there for those who would eventually, after Pentecost, become his followers, had the opportunity to, you know, to exercise their freedom. But they soon found, obviously, was that they were in direct conflict with the existing, you know, authorities of the time, and the persecutions, you know, started until Constantine.
Well, if it's so bad to have any kind of Christian influence in the school curriculum, why is it that everybody sits still for humanism?
Oh, you mean the secular humanist argument?
Yeah.
Yeah, that, there you get into an argument of, semantics, but it's an important one. The argument is that if you have a curriculum, I thought I saw Sally here, up there. You can chip in with Sid Simon on values clarification if you like, and so on. Okay, Sally's a senior high school teacher here. But anyway, the argument is that if you don't have any explicit Judeo or Christian input in the school, aren't you in a very real sense still having a religion? Isn't the absence of an organized religion like the Judeo or the Christian faith a religion in and of itself? Because there's no such thing as nothing. I mean, nothing, a nothing religion is some kind of a religion. You're saying that there is no organized, transcendent, level of truth.
I think you have to try to introduce religion wherever you can in our beliefs, but you can't do it within the framework of government. It's got to be kind of, whenever you can, we can't go through the procedures, though, because once we start agreeing to procedures, then we got to compromise.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
I'd be interested, just from what you were saying from Southeast Idaho, do you find that the Mormon Church has any kind of extra special advantage in the public schools? You teach in a Mormon area.
You talking to me?
No, to him, to her.
Oh, yeah, I don't teach.
No, okay.
With the Mormons, at first, like our church experiences are different. And I started feeling like, well, maybe the high school teachers didn't know I was new or didn't they like me. And somebody made the comment, well, it's not that they don't like you, but they know you're a Lutheran. And it used to be where they would hire mainly from the Mormon area. But I couldn't see how they could look at my resume, which was California Lutheran College. and not know my interests or my background. And another example is that I live near the only United States experimental sheep station, which has a Mormon director, and I guess it was just 3 years after the federal government had to step in because they were only hiring Mormons. And the Mormon teachers have a little bit more freedom to teach with their faith and give their moral views in the classrooms.
In the classrooms.
In learning the classrooms.
So in a sense then, if there were some children who were of non-Mormon backgrounds, they might be subjected to some even indirect kinds of pressures.